We love supporting and promoting the creators of musical theater throughout the world, and we would love to have your support as well. Go to musicaltheaterradio.com and click on the Become a Patron button, because a supportive community is a strong community. Welcome back to another episode of Be Our Guest here on Musical Theater Radio. I am your host, as always, Jean-Paul Yovanoff. It is time for you, the listeners, to discover another new musical, because that's what we love to do. We love helping new works and their creators find larger audiences. So without further ado, let's welcome Christopher Gile, the creator of the musical Cadman's Song, to the show. Christopher, welcome.
Thanks. Thanks for having me, Jean-Paul.
No problem.
You kind of got me through the lockdown. That's when I found your podcast when I was podcasting. You know, I thought I need to hear something about something. So thanks for having that podcast, because I rifled through them during the lockdown.
Yeah. Well, thank you for listening. I'm glad you did. Sure. I'm happy to have you on, because like I said, I love talking about new shows and introducing them to lots of people. But before we get to the show, I always want to, and if you're a listener of the podcast, you already know this, I ask the 30-second bio. So in 30 seconds, who is Christopher Gile?
Well, thank you for asking. Chris Gile is a dude that lives in Kansas City. I'm a musician, a songwriter, and I'm now a playwright and a composer, which are all fancy terms for I just like to write things. Grew up in Iowa. I'm from rural Iowa, and I went to school and I got my degree in special education, but I always had, my aspirations were always to be a songwriter and to be a musician. And my wife and I lived in Tennessee, in Nashville for many years. And so I was kind of on the fringe of that world for about 13 years. And then we moved back to the Midwest. All my kids were born in Tennessee. So, you know, Nashville's kind of in that Middle Tennessee area is my secondary stomping grounds. So, I have four boys. They're all into the performing arts. They're all grown. My wife was grew up in a dance studio, so we were just destined to show off. We're big show offs.
Nice.
That.
So I'm always curious. Were you the black sheep of the family growing up? Were you always into musical theater, or was that something you discovered a little bit later?
Well, what happened was I was not into theater at all. At 0%. Part of it was there was no outlet for an Iowa farm boy to be able to do that. However, I will have to say that, and we had very few TV channels. I'm a man of a certain age. I'm going to be 60 on my next birthday, so I'm an older dude. We had ABC, CBS and NBC were our three stations that we could get. And then we had, and thank goodness for PBS, because we ended up watching a lot of PBS and we watched a lot of movie musicals and a lot of things to do with music. So I ended up, you know, getting my education in symphonic music and in, I know in Iowa, they have Dixieland is a big part of Iowa culture as well as, that. And so it was really with PBS really kind of introduced me into that. And I always loved it. I always enjoyed it, but I thought that's not what I can do. I was into sports and I was into playing the guitar and writing songs. And I was really more of a rocker than I was anything else. So, yeah.
I know what you mean about the four stations. Yeah. I grew up an hour north of Toronto, but we only got four stations, cows and corns for neighbors. So yeah, I exactly. Totally get what you went through growing up.
It just ended up that I had a knack I had a good singing voice. I had a high school teacher, vocal music teacher that was a University of Iowa graduate, and he was fresh out of grad school, and he himself was an opera singer, and I was really like scraggly and long haired and didn't, you know, I did not. And he said, hey, I think you can really sing. So he introduced me into singing a lot of opera. Mm-hmm. So I learned just in my high school years, I did learn how to interpret German and French and Italian. And I sang a bunch of opera, and I really had that type and that voice really helped me in the pop music too. So I was kind of always skirting around it. But I will say the thing that my other caveat is that I probably for maybe 5 years, maybe 10 years, listened to the Jesus Christ Superstar cast album every week for just a number of years. And it was the concept album, not the cast album, the Murray Head, Ian Gillan, the concept album. And I was obsessed with that album. And I listened to that album at least once a week, just all through middle school and high school. So I still pull it out sometimes. So yeah.
So the roots were all there. Everything was there. It just wasn't ready yet to come out.
Right. I didn't think it was a thing I could do. Yeah. I didn't have a, then when I got to college, my wife was an established dancer in the dance group at the university I was at. And I really liked her. And so I started going to a few of her shows, started meeting the people around that. And then she's from St. Louis. We went to the Muni one time in St. Louis, and the Muni has free seats. I don't know if you've ever been to the Muni.
Not yet.
Yeah, I mean, you can go and sit in the free seats, and it's a mile away. They just looked so tiny down there, but it was free. And we saw a show, and it was some jukebox show. I didn't think it was, and I didn't know what it was. And then the more I started watching, I was like, you know, I think I could, everything they're doing, I think I could do that. So I didn't act or do anything like that until I was in college. And then I didn't get a theater minor, but we were allowed to take as many theater classes and do anything we needed to do in our college. So I you know, got several roles and was in several shows, and that's kind of where that came from.
Yeah. The Muni is a place I interviewed about a month ago, the marketing director, and we were talking about it, and that's kind of like a rock performance of 11,000 people meets right. theater. It's crazy. And yeah, that's an experience I would really love to have.
The thing that's funny, because I've been to a bunch of shows at the Muni, is that, you know, the stage is huge from wing to wing. Mm-hmm. So I always chuckle when someone's at center stage and they do their scene, and then they got to go to the next scene. They sprint at just breakneck speed to get off because you were so far away from the wings. And I'm always rooting for them to, you know, you can make it, dude. You can go, you know, catch your breath. You got to be right back on and do this tap number, but, you know, too bad. You know.
Yeah, that is, yeah, I got to get down there because I just want to see that crazy 11,000 seat.
Yeah.
Theater, that's awesome that you were able to be there and helped inspire you. That's very cool. So you went into education. What was the moment that you decided to is this musical that we're going to talk about, is that your first one? Or
it is I had you kind of, as I look back on my songwriting adventures, I guess, I was always writing things thematically. Mm-hmm. So I would, and I love concept albums, you know what I mean? So that connected storytelling and connected songwriting, I really already enjoyed. I had actually written I was in this group that, it was a quasi theater group, but we did it in the dark. So we had like projections, then we were in the dark, and then we would sing and do the different parts. People would watch something, we would play it live. And I did write an hour long program about generational interconnectedness, was kind of what it was about an old man and a young man. And I wrote a bunch of songs for it, and it was like exactly an hour. So in that sense, I did write kind of a connected piece with dialogue that was projected. But I never thought of that as like a live piece. So it wasn't really until I kind of have the worst story about this. My kids did a lot of youth theater, and there's a lot of great youth theater products, and there are some products that are not necessarily so great for people to watch. You know what I mean? There's a lot of youth theater where the cast is very happy to do it, and the parents are very happy that the cast is doing it, and then you enjoy your kids doing the show, and that's where your enjoyment ends there.
Because, been there. Yep.
I mean, I don't mean to be a jerk about it, but you know, I have four kids that have all been through it, so I've seen many things. And I found out how much this publishing company was charging our youth theater promo. I don't know, like $12,000. I go, $12,000? They should be paying you to do the show. I can't believe that you're paying for this. So I thought, I can write something as mediocre as that, and I'll just let people do it for free. So I had the worst attitude, and I came from the worst place to do it. But I did have an idea that I'd had before, and then I started taking it seriously. And yeah, so it was kind of the genesis of it was not awesome on my part, but you know, it got me going. So yeah,
exactly. You can't control where inspiration comes from. It's just, yeah, I've sat through some of those, and yeah, I don't know how you did it through four children.
There's a lot of great youth theater in Kansas City. Yeah. And we got into a really great that they decided to move towards more artistically challenging works. And so, you know, that I feel like my kids got a great theater training, but on the front end, there were some shows that were like, oh, all right, you know, and they can't all be awesome, for you sure. know, but it would be great if some of them were awesome at some point. And then it grew to that. So.
So let's talk about this show that's inspired by all of that. Kaithman's song. Tell us a little bit about the synopsis of it.
Well, it's a complicated song. I'll give you my pitch first. Sure. And let me just see. This is the pitch that my son developed, and I feel like it's good. So let's say, for instance, we're just meeting as if we are, because we are. Yeah. John Paul.
Yes.
Do you know anyone in your life that just can't sing at all? They can't carry a tune. They can't articulate anything. And matter of fact, when they start singing, do you feel like maybe they should go ahead and stop singing? Do you know anybody like that? Maybe it's you, maybe it's someone you know. If that person came to you tomorrow and sang to you the most beautiful song you had ever heard, would that be a miracle?
Yeah, maybe, yeah.
That's what the show's about.
Interesting.
Yeah, so that's kind of my little hook there. It's based upon a historical figure from the 650s, the 7th century, 650s on. His name is Cademan of Whitby. Whitby is a city in what's called Northumbria. Now it's called it's Yorkshire now. So it's in between, it's on the east side of England. Scotland's here. Yorkshire here, and here's a little place called Whitby, and it is a port city, and they have a monastery there, and there was a guy in the 600s named Cademan of Whitby, and Cademan could not sing. He said, I don't have the tongue for song, and one night he was at a tavern, and they were singing at the tavern. He got very discouraged because he didn't have the tongue for song and he could not sing along. And he stumbled up into the pasture because he took care of animals for the abbey there and fell asleep in the pasture. And then he was awoken by an angel. And the angel woke him up and said, Cademan, I need you to sing me a song. And Cademan said, you know I can't sing a song. He said, no. The angel said, I need you to sing me a song. I need you to sing me a song about the creation of all things. And he could sing, and he sang this song, his first song he ever wrote, called Cademan's Hymn, in about, you know, maybe 660 AD. And it is a song that has 9 lines that remain that you can see in different places in England. And it is considered the first song ever written in English. So Cademan was the first poet to write in English, and this Cademan's Hymn was the first song ever written in English. Everything else before then had been written in Latin or had been written in the Germanic languages, but this was a unique, called Old English, and it was the first song written in English. So I thought that it was interesting to have a hero of a musical who can't sing. And I thought that's interesting. Here's a guy who couldn't sing and then suddenly could sing. He became a saint, and the Catholic Church then adopted this idea of the vernacular hymns, where everything was always written in Latin before, and you would have a Latin mass. And then people of any city that didn't know Latin, especially in England, they didn't know. They, matter of fact, they didn't even have their own centralized language. They had many different dialects in Britain. But Cademan came in, he would write songs in that people could understand, the common people, and to this day it's called vernacular hymns. So anyway, that's a little bit about Cademan. I got the idea from, there is a scholar called the father of English history, called the Venerable Bede. I don't know if you ever heard of the Venerable Bede. A lot of English lit people will know the Venerable Bede. He was the first person to write history about England. And he has this story, just a bunch of stories that he collected. He just went around and just got folk stories and wrote them down and put that in his account. And this is a little story that's kind of tucked into his book called The History of the English Speaking People is what it's called. And it's just this little blurb that's in there, but I just found it interesting. So that's kind of where it came from.
Very cool. Yeah. So you've come up with the idea. How was that writing process for you? Was it something easy, something difficult? Because I know I talk to a lot of people and their first time, they don't know the rules, but that's kind of good because you don't know what you're doing wrong. You just do it. So what was that process like for you?
It was a little bit of just do it. From the song perspective, I was familiar with that. So I'm familiar with how to write songs and what makes a song work and what makes a song when a song doesn't work, I understand why it doesn't work. And I am primarily someone that was involved in creating music and melody lines more than lyrics. That was my function in Nashville, is that I was a lyric, or I was a melody line guy. I could play the piano and the guitar, and I do arrangements. Other people would bring songs and we would kind of work on them and I would kind of flesh them out. That was one of my functions in Nashville. So I understood that. I didn't want to lean on my ability to write music and melody lines and come up with a bunch of music and then try to stick words on top of it. So what I did, because I like to make things hard on myself, is that I wrote the first song. It's the I Want song. It's called I Know There's a Song in My Heart. And when I wrote that song, it's the second song of the show. When I wrote that song and kind of crafted it, and I said, okay, this song has got potential. I played it for some other people. People are like, people ask, can I put that in my book? You know, people, it's a baritone, yeah. Tenor song. It doesn't go too high, but it does show power. It's a song that worked. And then I wrote the very last song, the closing number. And I did, I said, I put away the piano, I played it on the guitar. I wanted it to be a kind of Highland melodies and some kind of Scottish, Northumbrian pipes. It's a type of, kind of a small bagpipe, and they have very limited tones on it. So a lot of their melody lines are pretty compact, but they move a lot. So I tried to listen to that Northumbrian step music, and I said, I want to have something that has that kind of feel that makes you want to do it like a step dance or a folk dance. And I wrote that. That worked really well. I kind of showed it to people, and they're like, they both liked really like. Then for like a year, I put all that away and did nothing but write words. And the way I had to do it was I had a journal and I just wrote down things that I wanted to see, just longhand. Then from that, then I went through and I kind of outlined where I wanted things to go. And then I kind of put this song, we need a song here, a song here, a song here. Some of it was very practical as far as that goes. Like I wanted all the main characters to have their own song. I wanted to keep the songs and the musical pieces to about 20. And I also wanted to keep the script under 100, so at 100 or under 100 pages. So I kind of gave myself these parameters. And then I went through and just kind of developed what I wanted the themes to be. And then I picked out different styles, but I had just text and text and text, just all this text, which is, I felt like that was my thing that I didn't know how to do. And it was also the thing that I needed the most help on. And I knew it was the thing that I needed to just craft the most. And I don't know if you're familiar, John Paul, with kind of the Nashville way of writing songs. There is a Nashville, I don't want to, it's not a rule, but it is just kind of this way, you know. Nashville is very interested in hooks, mm-hmm. which, you know what I mean by a hook, right? A musical phrasing, beautiful melodies, and but especially musical hooks and lyrical hooks. Yep. That in Nashville loves story-driven songs that are narratives, and they are also, and we, and everything I went to, all the songwriting stuff I went to, they pounded this idea of your song melody is like prime real estate on the Vegas Strip, and you want to put the most impactful syllables and words to showcase them. You don't want to buy this beautiful piece of ground that you want people to go on and then put like a Cash America cash place and a thrift store over here, and you know, and like, you don't want to just use, you don't want to come up with kind of trashy, mm-hmm. you know, you want to have the best words that you can. And so there was a lot of that where then you start culling down and culling down and culling down, and then you say, okay, can I make this word richer? Can I make this, you know, can I make this clever? And I'm also committed to rhymes. I'm not always committed to rhymes, but this, I was very committed to rhymes. So trying to make the rhymes clever and then make, yeah. So there was, so it was a lot of muddle through. I don't know what your question was, but something about how did I do something about something, but it was, that was the part that was very difficult and took me, that's why it took me many years. So once, and what I did was, is I tried to meter, I would write a song and I would have an idea, maybe what a melody line could sound like. And then I knew where to place the syllables for me to be able to work with it as far as melody lines and hooks and stuff. So then when I went to add music to the words, then that went a lot faster than me trying to just stick words into play. It would just would be awkward. So anyway, so that's kind of my process, was just a lot of rewrites, you know. I'm from the education field, so I tried to, what I did was, is I, you know, you have to write from a place that you know. Mm-hmm. And I have never been, I had never at that point been to Scotland or knew anything about anything. I mean, there was a lot of reading, and I like to geek out on that, a lot of reading. Mm-hmm. About the time period and the what was going on and trying to understand what was going on. And then once I understand more, I said, well, this is much richer than just a guy who couldn't sing and now he can sing. There's a deeper meaning. So then you start adding more meaning into it. So I just kind of nerded out on those details. And just keeping it, making it richer and richer and richer as far as that goes. And then we started doing readings, and then I would just talk to the actors. What do you think of this? It doesn't make any sense. This is, you know, and I took all the notes and then would run back and then just do rewrites. And even the other, I put probably 50 different actors through all the readings that we did. And, you know, I tried to find different ones quite a lot. So I didn't really have like a dramaturg get a hold of it. I think I went through about half of them had BFA degrees in theater. So they understood how scripts work and that kind of thing. So yeah, I don't know if I answered your question. It was a great question, but I just,
you did. You completely did answer the question. Yeah. So I'm curious. So from how long was it from initial concept to the, if you've had one, a first production of some kind on stage?
Well, I was in the first time I read about Caedmon was in a bookstore in Houston, and Texas, and at a Barnes and Noble, and that was like probably 2005. Okay. So the nugget of that being a good idea I had in there, and I thought I was just write one song from it. And then I thought I could write 10 songs about this and do kind of a thematic album, but I just, it didn't, you know, just kind of stayed back there. Then probably 5 or 6 years ago, someone said to me, or I was on a long distance trip, and it was just a long trip. And one of the people that was with us, just one of my kids' friends go, "Hey, Mr. Gal, you write songs. What would you write a show about?" And I was like, "Well, I have this idea about this guy who can't sing, but then he can sing. God makes him sing. He's trying to convince people that God gave him this ability to sing." And, you know, and I think that's a funny idea. I like that idea. That's kind of the first time that I said it. And it was probably, and then I wrote those couple songs. And then, so I would say I worked on it pretty substantially for 5 years. It was ready for Fringe in 2020, but you know,
yeah,
got killed. And that was good because the lockdown was it made me work on the things that I could work on. And so we made not really a cast album, but kind of a concept album. We did tens. I believe one of them's on your lovely radio network. We have we worked on this instead of just doing a bunch of demos. I worked really hard to make kind of a it's a proper album, you know. And so we did 10 songs called 10 Caedmon songs, and I just took 10 songs from the show and we kind of souped them up and rearranged them. And then I had my kids are in the show. My kids are all excellent singers and performers, and I got some of them to come in. We just did it here in this room and went through and did 10 of the songs. And so we got that ready. And then the thing that I like, and if other people listen to this and other directors, I'm sorry to say this, but I'm going to, there's a benefit to having Zoom rehearsals, because I was also directing youth theater shows in the meantime. I directed a number of shows. And when you're just sitting there, just looking at someone's face, you can really work on the words,
yeah,
and the dialogue, and you're not worried about how they walk from here to there. That can be a distraction. You can hear what they're saying, and then you can kind of have these, and then they're not quite looking directly at each other, so they can really concentrate. So that was, I found that really a great benefit as far as I can listen to people say the words and not get distracted by, "Oh, that light was this and their costumes that," you know. It made me only focus on the book. So yeah,
the pandemic was as horrific and terrible as it was, it's the people like yourself who took advantage of that time and created what you created, right? Used Zoom, took advantage of technology that none of us were using before,
right,
for this, and utilized it. And is Zoom going to replace or virtual? No, it will never replace live theater, but it is a tool, another tool in our toolbox.
Well, it's going to be something that I use for, I mean, everything's completely open here in Kansas City. I don't know about Toronto, but everything's completely open now. And there are very few places that are mask required.
Yeah.
However, I'm still going to do some sessions that are just a Zoom, mm-hmm, for the very reason that we can just work on that dialogue. That's always going to be part of my, you know, like when we did a full production in March.
Oh, nice.
This year. And if I had to just say something to everybody, we would just hop online and I could say it to them all at once. And I didn't have to try to get a room to say that, you know, it, like those meetings that were just informational meetings that I wanted feedback, that's kind of what that's for. So I'm going to always use that. So, yeah.
Yeah, it makes sense. It's a hybrid now of everything, you know. So
great kind of the thing, the kind of the thing that I was going to start talking is about I've been in the education business. That's my, I've taught small groups, giant groups of people. Yeah. So the way that Cademan's song works is that you are in a class, a master's level English lit class, and your professor is Professor Bede. And Professor Bede comes in. Matter of fact, he starts talking to people in the lobby and tells them, you know, we had the guy that we had do it this past time is really a, there's a big portion of the show, pre-show, that's improv. So he's running around telling people to sit down. He's getting people's homework. He's saying, you need to come in office hours just to, and really keep people off balance. And he's really funny. And then he would kind of start kind of calling people out. So the it's kind of a third wall light. It's a fluid third wall, fourth wall, I mean, fluid fourth wall, you know, because whenever, so he starts giving his lecture about the Cademan's hymn. And as he does it, then Cademan comes out and then it's a little drowsy chaperoning in a way, as far as that goes. Yeah. And then he just blends into the scenes. Sometimes he has lines, you know, and so he's the connective tissue. And because there is so much history and so much detail in the story, he's able to just pop in and just shoot information at people so they can understand what's going on, which was a lot easier than having characters say, you know, us living in Northumbria, we don't have the same language because we live in two different places. That's hard for us to communicate, isn't it? It is hard for us to communicate. I mean, that's, you have that weird dial. You don't have to do that. He just jumps in and say, hey, by the way, none of these people speak the same language. And then he jumps out and, you know, and things like that. And so it's so that the, it was light. Our sets were very bare minimum, and it's just real. We really just concentrated on the songs and the acting and the story kind of being right in the people's laps. So, yeah.
So if listeners are interested in the show and to maybe produce or put on, what is, you know, the target audience and, you know, number of characters and things like that, that people might need to know?
Got it. I wrote it for 15 actors. There's 15 roles. When we did it in March, I did it with 12. So what we did is we just took character, and almost all of the characters play multiple characters anyway. So it's broken up into tracks. So instead of saying you are this person, you are track, if you're track number 5, you cover probably 3 different people. And so there's a number in the script that says track 5 and then who you are. And then that's how you find out who you are. So it's 15 people. It can have an ensemble on top of that if you want to make it big, or you can do it. 12 was kind of the minimum that we could successfully do it. Now, John Paul, let me ask you this, because you know things and I don't know anything. So some of the feedback I've gotten from different producers and different theater people is that they are really looking for things 10 actors and under. Have you heard that number?
I've heard everything from 2 to 2 is the, you know, people are looking at that because it's cheaper and easier.
Exactly. Yeah.
But I've also heard people say, do what's right for the show. And that's, I'm the philosophy of, if you need 12, you need 12. And that's right. Just the way it is. And you know what, as a producer, either you'll figure it out or you'll have a community theater where you're going to find 40 people who can do it instead of, you know, right, going to off Broadway where the expensive. So in my opinion, which means nothing in the long run or everything, do what's best for the show, because the show is the most important part.
Yeah, I feel like I felt good about that 12 being kind of the optimal number. There was a lot of finagling of, because at first when you're doing something like that, it's like a puzzle. Mm-hmm. And then you get to rehearsal and you go, oh, they're having a conversation with themselves. you know, that's the same guy doing both things. So then I have to switch out, you know, and do a little bit of that. I felt like 12 was enough. It was six men and six women. It was good for the couples dancing, you know, and, you know, I like 12. So we're going to stick with 12. I have, you know, there's other things that I have developing as well that I'm trying to decide if I want to. I mean, you want to serve the market that you have, right? And so if it's like, we really only want four. So to me, I'm like, all right, well, maybe I need to think about this project, which is four people, you know, and I'm trying not to feel like that. I don't feel bad about that because I lived in Nashville where we wrote songs specifically for people. It's a product that you are putting out. So I get that. It doesn't bother me that much, but it seemed like I don't know how I could have done it with less than 12. So anyway, we're at 12. Yeah. It is a family friendly show. It also works well for faith-based groups. I didn't want any villains in the show. The villain was everybody's kind of disbelief because in the show, one of the things of the show is like, here's someone who we have made fun of his whole life, and now he's singing to us. So how are we going to deal with that? There's also other characters that do certain things. And so then you start looking across and, oh, well, this person I thought was this way, but maybe they're not that way. You know, so there's a lot of that in the show. I just wanted I didn't want there to be like a bad guy, like a cartoonish bad guy. Yeah. But there are protagonists and antagonists, but they're not villains. And yeah. Everybody at the end kind of overcomes, they've kind of come to see that they all have the same obstacle, even though they were antagonists and protagonists, and even though this is that. So there's a little bit of that. There's not just a cartoonish, just a bad guy in it. The male lead of Cademan is difficult. It's a difficult track. It's got range, and people have loved the score. That's been the number one comment I've gotten from people, is that they love that album, and that people have been loving the score. And the other thing is, when we did I think it's a lot of silliness. It's a silly show. It's absurd. It's got a lot of absurdity in it. There's a lot of Monty Python references in it. You know what I mean? I think it's a lot of side glances, and you're out to the audience. The audience is in on the joke. You know what I mean? It's like, it's kind of a communal experience, and things are happening out in the, you know, and that. But I've lived with it so long. You know, the theme is that if you have something in your heart that's your dream, don't discount it. That dream is for you to execute. And it is not just for you to enjoy yourself. Other people need to experience your dream with you. And that's what makes it great. And that's kind of the overall theme of the show. And I was so surprised during our run of how many weeping people would come up after the show. And they were just like, I don't know why I'm crying. I feel happy, but I said, buddy, you got something good in your heart to do, and you just need to go do it. And I've given you permission to do it. Now you need to go do that. And that's good. And that's right. And I had so many emotional responses for that. So I was I thought that was a whole lot of just showing off, but you know, people were kind of in their hearts were, you know, I guess I kind of numb to it. So yeah. So that was a good feeling. So I'm right now what I'm doing is I'm trying to get a college. I would like to get a college to do a workshop of it. And then I would like to get a production partner and then do another more extended, something that I didn't go raise all the money for myself. I really would like to not do that. So
people want to learn more about the show, do you have a website and social media that they can check out?
We do. It's CaedmonMusical.com, CAEDMON musical.com, and that has everything in it. I'm also, it's Caedmon Musical on Instagram and Facebook. I got some notes here. And then our album's on Spotify, Apple Music, Amazon Music, YouTube Music. It's called 10 Caedmon Songs. And I think homeschool groups or any kind of group would enjoy it because it does have a lot of that old English history. Matter of fact, we had a guy from England that came and saw the show in Kansas City. Afterwards, he goes, "I didn't know any of that." And I'm like, "That's your," and he goes, "I've heard of Lady Hilda and I've heard of Venerable B, but I didn't know that story was a thing." I go, "Yeah, that's a thing." So yeah.
Nice. Well, if people want to check out more, we play you on our station. We also have our one pager on our sampler platter. So if people want to just go to our website, if they've forgotten already the website, they can figure it out and get to you via us.
We have if someone's interested in being a production partner, they just message me, and then I have some information that's kind of locked that you need a password for. And then it has all the particulars for the show, including you can watch, we had a 3-camera video of two of our performances in March that represent very well what the show can be. So
Chris, congratulations on writing the show. Thank you for coming on and, you know, telling me and the listeners a little bit more about the show. And I look forward one day to see it as a full production on stage somewhere.
Me too. Yeah. And we're looking for our next one. So I really appreciate what you do, Jean-Paul. You have a specific niche that is very encouraging to people that just like me, that I just am in my bedroom by myself a lot, you know, being a playwright and being a songwriter. Yeah. But being a playwright, I think specifically, can be a very lonely, I've heard it was a very lonely task. I was like, dang, it is. It's hard to talk to people about it, you know, like, so anyway, I was in my office for 3 hours and I didn't, and people are just, they just glaze over like, "What are you doing?" I was like, "Ah, never mind, nothing. I'm doing anything." So yeah, so I appreciate what you're doing. Well, keep up the good work, man.
Thank you very much. My pleasure. So we were just speaking with Christopher Guile, the creator of the musical Caedmon's Song. Tune in next week as we'll be speaking with another guest or guests about their life, love, and passion that is musical theater. I'm your host as always, Jean-Paul Yovanoff. And until next time, I'll see you when I see you.